a successful senator and cynical historian, offers the most hard-hitting analysis of political corruption to survive from the ancient world, albeit written from the safe distance of the reign of Trajan in the early 2nd century CE. He certainly had an eye for the big picture. The first sentence of his Annales, or Chronicles, a history of the Julio-Claudian emperors from Tiberius to Nero, runs simply, "From the very beginning, kings have ruled the city of Rome. Urbem Romam, a principio regis habuere." In just 6 Latin words, it was a direct challenge to the ideological foundations of the regime and the insistence of the Augusti that they were not a monarchy in the old sense. But Tacitus regularly rests his case on the character and the crimes of the individuals on the throne. He embellishes his description, for example, of the attempted murder of Nero's mother, Agrippina, in the collapsible boat into a ghastly Baroque tale, including one horrible detail of human naivety and imperial ruthlessness. While Agrippina swam gamely to the shore, her drowning maid tried to save her own skin by shouting out that she was the emperor's mother. The desperate lie only ensured her instant slaughter at the hands of Nero's henchmen. Much of the great tradition of modern writing on the Roman emperors has been framed in similar terms, around imperial characters good and bad. The words of Edward Gibbon, whose History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire was published in instalments from 1776, have had an enormous influence on the views of generations of later historians. Before broaching the main theme of his title, Gibbon briefly reflects on the earlier period of one-man rule between Tiberius and Commodus, and he singles out for praise the emperors in the 2nd century CE. His memorable aphorism, crafted with typical 18th-century self-confidence, is still much quoted. "If a man were called to fix the period in history of the world during which the condition of the human race was most happy and prosperous, he would, without hesitation, name that which elapsed from the death of Domitian to the accession of Commodus." That is, what many since have called the period of the good emperors, Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian, Antonius Pius, Marcus Aurelius, and Lucius Verus. "These were rulers," Gibbon goes on, "whose characters and authority commanded involuntary respect, and who delighted in the image of liberty. Their only regret," he concludes, "must have been the knowledge that some unworthy successor, some licentious youth, or some jealous tyrant, would soon appear to ruin everything, as their predecessors had almost done in the past. The dark, unrelenting Tiberius, the furious Caligula, the feeble Claudius, the profligate and cruel Nero, and the timid, inhuman Domitian." It is a magisterial way of summing up almost 2 centuries of Roman history. Gibbon lived in an age when historians made judgments without hesitation and were prepared to believe that the Roman world might have been a better place to live than their own. It is also deeply misleading for several reasons. The various rulers were not easy to fit into any standard stereotypical image, Gibbon himself concedes, in lines that are now rarely quoted because they spoil the splendid certainty of the aphorism, that one of his favourites, Hadrian, could be vain, capricious and cruel, as much a jealous tyrant as an excellent prince. Gibbon must have known the story of how Hadrian had his architect put to death over a disagreement about building design. If true, it is a piece of imperial abuse worthy of Gaius. And some of the modern admirers of the gentle philosopher Emperor Marcus Aurelius would be less than admiring if they reflected on the brutality of his suppression of the Germans, proudly illustrated in the scenes of battle that circle their way up his commemorative column that still stands in the centre of Rome. Though less famous, it was clearly intended to rival Trajan's and was carefully built just a little taller. There are also all the problems of sorting fact from fantasy that we find in the various stories about the villainies of Gaius. The many ancient tales of imperial transgression certainly offer unforgettable insights into Roman anxieties, suspicions, and prejudices. How exactly Roman writers imagined that bad emperors revealed their badness can tell us an enormous amount about Roman cultural assumptions and morality more generally. From the particular frisson that attached, and still does, to sex in swimming pools, to the more surprising objection to cruelty to flies, probably a sign that there was nothing so trivial in the world that Domitian would not make a hobby out of hurting it. But as evidence for the reality of imperial rule, they remain a mixture of accurate reporting, exaggeration, and guesswork that it is almost always impossible to untangle. What went on behind the closed doors of the palace was usually secret. Some facts leaked out, some pronouncements were made in public, but for the most part, conspiracy theories flourished. It did not take much to turn a nearly tragic boating accident into a bungled murder attempt. How, anyway, did Tacitus know about the foolish gambit of Agrippina's servant? And what we would call urban myths abounded. More or less identical anecdotes and apparently spontaneous bon mots turn up in the biographies of different rulers. Was it Domitian or was it Hadrian who wryly observed that no one would believe there was a plot against an emperor until he was found dead? Maybe both of them. Maybe Domitian coined it and Hadrian repeated it. Or maybe it was a convenient cliché about the dangers of high rank that could be put in the mouth of almost any ruler. More generally, the politics of regime change had a major influence on how each emperor went down in history, as imperial careers and characters were reinvented to serve the interests of those who followed them. The basic rule of Roman history is that those who were assassinated were, like Gaius, demonized. Those who died in their beds, succeeded by a son and heir, natural or adopted, were praised as generous and avuncular characters, devoted to the success of Rome, who did not take themselves too seriously. These are the considerations that have recently encouraged a few brave revisionist attempts to rehabilitate some of the most notorious imperial monsters. A number of modern historians have presented Nero, in particular, more as a victim of propaganda of the Flavian dynasty, starting with Vespasian, which succeeded him, than as a self-obsessed, mother-killing pyromaniac who reputedly started the Great Fire of 64 CE, not just to enjoy the spectacle, but also to clear land for building his vast new palace, the Golden House. Even Tacitus admits, the rehabilitators point out, that Nero was the sponsor of effective relief measures for the homeless after the fire, and the reputed extravagance of his new residence with all its luxuries, including a revolving dining room, did not prevent the parsimonious Vespasian and his sons from taking over part of it as their home. Besides, in the 20 years after Nero's death in 68 CE, at least 3 false Neros, complete with lyre, appeared in the eastern parts of the empire, making a bid for power by claiming to be the emperor himself, still alive despite all the reports of his suicide. They were all quickly eliminated, but the deception suggests that in some areas of the Roman world, Nero was fondly remembered. No one seeks power by pretending to be an emperor universally hated. This historical scepticism is healthy, but it misses the bigger point, that whatever the views of Suetonius and other ancient writers, the qualities and characters of the individual emperors did not matter very much to most inhabitants of the empire, or to the essential structure of Roman history and its major developments. It probably did matter to some members of the metropolitan elite, the emperor's advisers, the Senate, and the palace staff. Day-to-day dealings with the teenaged emperor Nero may well have been rather more trying than those with Claudius before him or Vespasian after, and the absence of Tiberius in his retreat on Capri or of Hadrian on one of his many travels around the Roman world — he was an inveterate tourist, more often abroad than at home — must have had an impact on the administration for those directly concerned, including at one point Suetonius, who worked briefly in Hadrian's secretariat. Outside that narrow circle, however, and certainly outside the city of Rome, where the effects of an individual emperor's generosity could trickle down to the man or woman in the street, it can hardly have made much difference who was on the throne or what their personal habits or intrigues were. And there is no sign at all that the character of the ruler affected the basic template of government at home or abroad in any significant way. If Gaius or Nero or Domitian really were as irresponsible, sadistic and mad as they are painted, it made little or no difference to how Roman politics and empire worked, behind the headline anecdotes. Beneath the scandalous tales and stories of sodomy, which obscure as much as they enliven, away from the carefully constructed aphorisms of Gibbon, there was a remarkably stable structure of rule and, as we shall see, a remarkably stable set of problems and tensions across the whole period. It is those that we need to understand in order to make sense of imperial rule, not the individual idiosyncrasies of the rulers. After all, no horse was ever really made consul. Changes at the top. That is not to say that everything remained the same between 14 and 192 CE. There was an enormous expansion over that period in the palatial headquarters of imperial power. The staff of imperial administration grew out of all recognition, and the infrastructure became far more complicated. And by the early 2nd century CE, the emperor began to look very different to his subjects. The first Augustus had made a great show, and it was partly a show, of living more or less on a par with traditional Roman aristocrats. Within decades, though, the emperors were living in a style of luxury and extravagance that was unmatched in the Western world. The Roman town of Pompeii gives a clear sense of the scale of this change. In the 2nd century BCE, the biggest house in Pompeii, which we now know as the House of the Faun, after the bronze statue of a dancing faun or satyr, found there, roughly equaled the size of the palaces of some of the kings in the eastern Mediterranean who had grabbed, or been given, parts of the territory conquered by Alexander the Great. In the 2nd century CE, the villa, as it was now euphemistically known, that Hadrian built at Tivoli, a few miles from Rome, was bigger than the town of Pompeii itself. And there he recreated for himself a miniature Roman empire with replicas of the greatest imperial monuments and treasures, from Egyptian waterways to the famous temple of Aphrodite in the town of Cnidus, with its even more famous nude statue of the goddess. In between, the couple of houses that Augustus had occupied on the Palatine Hill had grown to be a full-blown palace. Nero was the most notorious of the first emperors for extravagant domestic building. His golden house incorporated state-of-the-art luxury and engineering, but the size was just as striking. The residential quarters and parkland together stretched, so it was said, across half the city, almost as if centuries later the Palace of Versailles had taken over the centre of Paris. It prompted some clever graffiti from its critics. "All Rome is becoming a single house. Flee to Veii, citizens," one wag scrawled. He was looking back to the proposal made centuries before, after the invasion of the Gauls in 390 BCE, that the Romans should abandon their city and set up home in what had been an enemy Etruscan town. But controversial as Nero's invasion of Rome was, his grand construction projects set the pattern for the future. By the late 1st century CE, the emperors were enjoying newly acquired luxurious suburban estates around the edge of most of the city, combinations of palace and pleasure parks known as horti, or gardens. And they had more or less taken over the whole of the Palatine Hill for their central headquarters, or palace from Palatine. This now included audience chambers, official dining rooms, reception suites, offices, baths, and accommodation for family, staff, and slaves. And right at its back door, symbolically close, was the bogus Hut of Romulus, where Rome had once begun. The palace was not only widely visible on many stories towering over the city, it had completely taken over the land on the Palatine that for centuries had been the favourite place for senators to live. It was here that Cicero had his main city house, as did Clodius and many other of the leading players in the politics of the Roman Republic. There could hardly be a clearer symbol of the change in the balance of power in Rome than that the best remains of those old Palatine houses are now found buried in the foundations of the later palace, or that the elite families, finding themselves pushed out of their district of choice, tended to migrate to the Aventine Hill, which in Rome's early days had been the stronghold of radical plebeians. Hand in hand with the expansion of the imperial palace went an expansion of the imperial administration at the central hub of the empire. Little is known in any detail about how the first Augustus's staff was organized, but it was probably an expanded version of the household of any leading senator of the previous century. Large numbers of slaves and ex-slaves, acting in every capacity from cleaners to secretaries, with family and friends as advisers, confidants, and sounding boards. That is certainly the impression given by the occupants of a large communal tomb, a so-called columbarium, or dovecot, discovered in 1726 on the Appian Way. This originally contained the ashes of more than 1,000 of the slaves and ex-slaves of Livia, with small plaques recording their names and jobs. Those that survive give a snapshot of her staff. They include 5 doctors and a medical supervisor, 2 midwives, presumably for the rest of the household, a painter, 7 seamstresses or menders, a bedroom attendant, Capsarius, possibly the ancient equivalent of handbag carrier, a caterer and a eunuch, function unspecified. This looks like the slave staff that any aristocratic lady might have had, but on a vastly expanded scale. Where they all lived is something of a mystery. They can hardly have fitted into the imperial couple's palatine houses, and presumably must have been lodged elsewhere. By the time of Claudius, 30 years later, there was an administrative organization attached to the emperor on a completely different scale and level of complexity. A series of departments or bureau had been established to deal with different aspects of administration, separate offices for Latin correspondence and Greek correspondence, another to handle petitions to the emperor, another accounts, another to prepare and organize the legal cases judged by the emperor. They were largely staffed by slaves, many hundreds of them, and headed by divisional managers, who were at first usually ex-slaves, reliable administrators whose loyalty to the emperor could more or less be guaranteed. But when the immense power that these men wielded became something of a cause célèbre with the traditional elite, members of the equestrian class replaced them as managers. The senators never enjoyed being upstaged by a powerful servile underclass prancing around, as they would have seen it, above their station. This looks very much like a modern civil service. But in one important sense, it was not. There is no sign of the clearly defined hierarchies below the divisional managers, or of the grading of posts, the qualifications and examinations that we now associate with the modern Western or ancient Chinese idea of the civil service. So far as we can tell, it was still based on the structure of the old-fashioned slave household, such as Cicero's, even if vastly magnified. But it also points to another aspect of the emperor's job that often gets forgotten among all the tales of luxury and excess. The paperwork. Most Roman rulers spent longer at their desks than at the dinner table. They were expected to work at the job, to be seen to exercise practical power, to respond to petitions, to adjudicate disputes throughout the empire, and to give verdicts in tricky legal cases, right down to those that from the outside, though not to the parties involved, no doubt, appear relatively trivial. On one occasion, so a long inscription explains, the first Augustus was asked to pass judgment on a brawl in Cnidos, where the famous Aphrodite came from, on the southwestern coast of modern Turkey. It was a nasty local fight that had ended with one thug being killed by a falling chamber pot, accidentally dropped by a slave from the upper window of the house that the victim was attacking. Who was guilty? Augustus had to decide. The assailant or the pot dropper, or his owner? It was the support of the emperor's increasingly large staff that made it possible to deal with many cases like this, with the sacks of letters arriving in the palace post-rooms, and the streams of envoys that turned up, all expecting an imperial answer or audience. In that sense, it was rather like a modern civil service, for it must often have been a team of slaves and ex-slaves who read the documents, advised the emperor on the appropriate course of action, and no doubt drafted many of the decisions and replies. Realistically, a good proportion of the letters from the emperor, received by local communities in the provinces and proudly put on display, inscribed in permanent form in marble or bronze, can hardly have been more than nodded through by him and stamped with his seal. But maybe that did not matter much to the recipients. The majority of those who lived in the provinces, or even in Italy, had only the vaguest idea, if any, of what the imperial palace was like, or how the emperor's administration operated. Only a tiny number would ever have seen the living emperor. They would, however, have seen his image over and over again, on the coins in their purses and in his portraits that continued to flood the Roman world. The atmosphere was not so different from that of a modern dictatorship, with the ruler's face peering out from every shop front, street corner, and government department. It even occasionally was converted into edible form, stamped into the biscuits distributed at religious sacrifices, as a few of the surviving biscuit moulds make clear. In fact, the 2nd century CE scholar, teacher and courtier Marcus Cornelius Fronto, in a letter to his grandest pupil, Marcus Aurelius, treated the spread of imperial images as a source of pride, even if he was sniffy about the artistic talents on display in the spontaneous initiatives of the ordinary people. In all the banks, shops, bars, gables, colonnades, windows, everywhere, he wrote, portraits of you are on public display, even if they are badly painted and modelled, and carved in crude, almost worthless style. The emperor's face was ubiquitous, but it could be represented very differently. Only those with their eyes half shut could have failed to spot a dramatic change near the beginning of the 2nd century CE, in how the ruler looked. With the accession of Hadrian in 117 CE, after more than 100 years of imperial portraits with no trace of facial hair, only a little stubble if they were supposed to be in mourning, emperors started to be portrayed with full beards, a trend that lasted throughout the rest of the century and well after the period covered by this book. It is a guaranteed way of dating all those imperial heads that now line museum shelves. If they are bearded, they are after 117 CE. This change cannot have been merely a whim of fashion, or, as one ancient writer predictably speculated, a device for Hadrian to cover his spots. But the reason for it remains puzzling. Was it an attempt to emulate the Greek philosophers of the past? Hadrian was a well-known admirer of Greek culture, as was the philosophical Marcus Aurelius. So was it part of an attempt to intellectualize Roman imperial power, to represent it in Greek terms? Or did it point to the opposite direction, harking back to the tough military heroes of earliest Rome, even before the era of Scipio Barbatus in the early 3rd century BCE, when to sport a beard seemed already to have been something remarkable in a Roman? It is impossible to know, and no ancient writing that survives ever explains the new beards, But at the very least, they hint that within the palace someone was thinking hard about the imperial image, right down to the facial hair, and, for whatever reason, was prepared to make a break from tradition. Important and visible as some of these developments were, the basic structures of imperial power, as the first Augustus had formulated them, remained in place throughout the rule of these 14 emperors, no matter who was on the throne. Tiberius, near the beginning of the 1st century CE, would not have found it difficult to slip into the imperial shoes of Commodus near the end of the 2nd. They all continued to blazon the title Augustus amid a string of other often very similar names. It has always taken a sharp eye to distinguish Caesar Publius Aelius Trajanus Hadrianus Augustus from the man who was emperor after him, Caesar Titus Aelius Hadrianus Antonius Augustus Pius, the pair better known as Hadrian and Antonius Pius. To their face they were all called Caesar. "Hail Caesar, those about to die salute you," as gladiators occasionally shouted to the emperor before fights, would have been a form of address appropriate to each and every one of them. They all continued to follow the Augustan precedent in building their way into power, in flaunting their generosity to the people, and in displaying their military prowess. Or they were much criticised if they did not. Vespasian's most famous construction, the amphitheatre, inaugurated under his son Titus in 80 CE, cleverly combined all three aims. Eventually known as the Colosseum, from a colossal statue of Nero that stood close by, and lasted long after Nero's end, this was simultaneously a massive building project. It took almost 10 years to finish, using 100,000 cubic metres of stone, a commemoration of his victory over Jewish rebels, the booty from the war paid for it, and a conspicuous act of generosity to the Roman people, the most famous popular entertainment venue ever. It was also a criticism of his predecessor, pointedly built on the site that had once belonged to Nero's private park. But the 14 emperors were also heirs to the problems and tensions that Augustus bequeathed. For the Augustan template, though enduringly solid in some respects, was in others a precarious balancing act. It had left some issues perilously unresolved. In particular, Augustus had never solved the problem of succession to imperial power. He had left the role of the Senate and the relationship between the emperor and the rest of the elite highly contested, and more generally, awkward questions remained about how the power of the ruler of the Roman world was to be defined and represented. How, for example, did the parade of civilitas, or the idea that he was simply the first among equals, primus inter pares, in the Latin slogan, fit with vast imperial honours and the emperor's nearly divine status? Exactly how close to a god was the Roman ruler? All emperors and their advisers had to grapple with these dilemmas, which lie just below the surface of many of the lurid anecdotes. Several of the stories of the poisoning of imperial heirs, for example, point to the uncertainty of the rights of succession. The bantering insults of Gaius to his long-suffering consuls reflect the edgy relationship between Senate and ruler. So it is to these defining conflicts of imperial power that we now turn, the succession. The Senate and the status of the emperor, divine or not, they are as important to our understanding of how Roman imperial politics worked as the mammoth building schemes, military campaigns, and generous benefactions, far more important than all the curious stories about crime, conspiracy, or horses as consuls. Succession. The murder of Gaius was a particularly bloody case of regime change, but the transmission of imperial power in Rome was often murderous. Despite the impressive survival rate of the emperor's 14 rulers in almost 200 years is one testament to stability. The moment of succession was fraught with violence and surrounded by allegations of treachery. Vespasian, in 81 CE, was the only emperor in the first two dynasties to die without any rumours of foul play surfacing. Gaius, Nero, and Domitian met obviously violent ends. There were rumours of murder surrounding the deaths of all the others. The names, dates, and details change, but the story remains the same. Some said that Livia poisoned Augustus to ease Tiberius onto the throne. Tiberius was widely believed to have been poisoned or smothered to make way for Gaius. Agrippina is supposed to have dispatched her husband Claudius with some poisoned mushrooms in her successful bid to make her son Nero emperor. And some said that Domitian had a hand in the early death of Titus, contrary to a hopeful story in the Talmud, which claims that after Titus destroyed the temple in Jerusalem, a gnat flew into his nostril and gradually ate away his brain. Many of these stories must be fiction. It takes a lot to believe that the elderly Livia would have painstakingly smeared poison on figs still growing on a tree, then tricked her husband into eating them. But true or not, together they underlined the uncertainty and danger in the transmission of power. The message was that succession almost never happened without a struggle or a victim. This was a pattern projected back to the myths of the early kings, too. They enjoyed long reigns, but only two of the seven died natural deaths. Why was it so difficult? And what solutions did the Romans find? The first Augustus intended to make one man rule permanent and to keep it in the family. But the series of deaths among those marked out as his heirs, and the lack of any surviving sons from his marriage to Livia, dogged his plans. Succession throughout the first dynasty continued to be fraught, as different claims from different sides of the Julio-Claudian family tree clashed. But the problems were bigger than that, and they would not have disappeared even if the imperial couple had produced half a dozen healthy boys. Augustus was trying to invent from scratch a system of dynastic succession against the background of a fluid set of Roman rules about the inheritance of status and property. Crucially, there was no presumption in Roman law that the firstborn son would be the sole or principal heir. The standard modern system of primogeniture is a fail-safe mechanism for removing any doubt about who should succeed, although by making the order of birth the only criterion, it risks some decidedly unsuitable incumbents on the throne. In Rome, the eldest male child of the emperor would have had a certain advantage in trying to follow his father, but no more than that. A successful claim to power also rested on behind-the-scenes manoeuvres, on the support of key interest groups, on being groomed for the part, and on the careful manipulation of opinion. It also depended on being in the right place at the right time. The only reliable way to guarantee a peaceful transition was to have the new emperor on the spot to take over the old Augustus's signet ring as he breathed his last, with no awkward gap. That is what the rumour-mongers realised. Most of the allegations of poisoning under the Julio-Claudians present the murder not as part of a plot to spring some new candidate into power, but as an attempt to get the timing right and to ensure a seamless takeover for the man already marked out as the likely successor. These uncertainties about how to establish a legitimate claim to rule also help to explain the peculiarly murderous image of the Roman imperial court, where danger seems to have lurked on every fig, and such an atmosphere of suspicion prevailed that Domitian is said to have had the palace walls lined with reflecting stone so that he could see who was coming up behind. Without any agreed system for the transmission of power, every relative counted as a potential rival of the emperor or of his likely heir. And it followed that those in the penumbra of the imperial family found themselves in a very perilous position indeed. Many of the stories may well be more fantasy than fact. The Roman elite was not by nature particularly cruel and ruthless, even if that is the image they have in film and fiction. What was ruthless was the fundamental logic of imperial succession. Tacitus captures that, with characteristic cynicism, in describing the events of the beginning of Nero's reign in 54 CE. "The first death under the new emperor," he starts, implying that there were many more to follow, "was that of Marcus Junius Solanus Torquatus, the governor of Asia. He was a man of no ambition whatsoever, so shamelessly apathetic," Tacitus explains, "that Gaius had aptly nicknamed him the Golden Sheep. But his death was inevitable, and the reason obvious. He was a great-grandson of Augustus." There were alternative routes to power. One was exactly what the first Augustus had tried to preclude, elevation by the army. In 41 CE, the Praetorian Guard in Rome had played the leading part in putting Claudius on the throne. In 68 CE, to quote Tacitus again, "the secret of imperial rule was revealed, that an emperor could be made somewhere other than Rome." "Somewhere other than Rome" is a euphemism for "by the legions in the provinces," as each of the four rival claimants to replace Nero was backed by army units from different provinces. Within 18 months, Vespasian was raised to power in the east, with no connection by birth to the Julio-Claudian dynasty. It is clear, however, that he and his supporters felt that military force alone was not enough to secure his position. Despite the down-to-earth image he later projected at the beginning of his rule, widespread reports of the miracles he had worked underpinned his claims to the throne. In Egypt, just before his proclamation as emperor, he is supposed to have restored sight to a blind man by spitting on his eyes, and to have cured another man's withered hand by standing on it. Whatever carefully manipulated display lay behind these reports, and whatever the uncanny similarity with a far better-known miracle worker of the 1st century CE, eyewitnesses are said to have vouched for the miraculous cures years later, long after Vespasian's death. The Praetorians continued to influence imperial succession. Certainly no one would have been able to hold on to the throne if the troops in the city actively opposed him. But in the period up to 192 CE, they never again engineered quite such an open coup as they had in 41 CE, nor, in that period, did the legions in the provinces ever again create an emperor. That is partly because, from the end of the 1st century CE, after a brief interlude of relatively unproblematic succession, in which Vespasian had been followed by his two natural sons, an alternative route to the throne was devised, which appeared to get round some of the earlier difficulties. Adoption. Adoption in Rome had never been principally a means for a childless couple to create a family. If anyone just wanted a baby, they could easily find one on a rubbish dump. Adoption among the elite had always been a means to ensure the transmission of status and property, and the continuance of the family name in the absence of surviving sons. Those adopted were more likely to be distinguished adolescents or young adults than babies, whose high risk of death made them an unwise investment. That is how Scipio Aemilianus, for example, the friend of Polybius and conqueror of Carthage in 146 BCE, the natural son of another famous Roman commander, Aemilius Paulus, ended up in the Scipio family. It was not at all surprising that Augustus and his successors in the Julio-Claudian dynasty used adoption, as other elite families sometimes did, to mark out their favoured heir among the wider group of relatives. Hence Augustus adopted his grandsons, and when they died, did the same thing with Livia's natural son, Tiberius. Claudius likewise adopted his wife's son, Nero. But from the end of the 1st century CE there was a new pattern. When Domitian was assassinated in 96 CE, the Senate offered the throne to the elderly and childless Nerva, a safe pair of hands, presumably. Between Nerva and Marcus Aurelius, heirs to the throne were selected and adopted, without obvious concern for family relationships. Some had no link to the existing emperor by blood or marriage at all, or only a remote one, and they came from further afield. Trajan, the first such adoptee, was originally from Spain. The families of others came from either there or Gaul. There were descendants of early Roman settlers abroad, who had probably married into the local communities, rather than from the indigenous population. But, in a way that dramatically fulfilled the Roman project of incorporation, they made the point that the emperor could come from the provinces of the empire. This new system, which operated for most of the 2nd century CE, was sometimes presented as a major shift in the ideology of political power, almost a meritocratic revolution. Gaius Plinius Caecilius Secundus, now called Pliny the Younger, to distinguish him from his uncle, the elder, justified the procedure in precisely those terms in a speech delivered to the Emperor Trajan. When you are about to hand control of the Senate and the people of Rome, the armies, the provinces, the allies, to one man alone, would you look to the belly of a wife to produce him, or search for an heir to supreme power only within the walls of your own home? If he is to rule over all, he must be chosen from all. Tacitus, also writing during the rule of Trajan, echoes those sentiments in a speech he put into the mouth of Servius Sulpicius Galba, one of the claimants who briefly held power after the death of Nero. Just a few days before his death, elderly and without an heir, Galba looked for someone outside his family to adopt as a successor. Tacitus's words ostensibly justify that decision in 69 CE, but they really belong to the world of imperial adoption in his day. Under Tiberius and Gaius and Claudius, he makes Galba say, we Romans became the inheritance of just one family. Now that the Julio-Claudian dynasty is over, adoption will select only the best. For to be descended and born from emperors is pure chance, and is rated no more highly. These are fine words, and they suggest a new style of reflection on the nature of the emperor's power and qualities. In practice, too, the adoptive system occasionally worked smoothly. On the death of Nerva in 98 CE, Trajan's succession was so guaranteed that the new emperor did not even return to Rome from Germany for more than a year. But it was not the perfect solution that some of the glowing ancient accounts make it seem. To read between the lines, it is clear that the Praetorians had pressured Nerva into adopting Trajan. Pliny's speech lets out rather awkwardly that Trajan had been forced on the old man, and the legions massed with Trajan on the Rhine might well have been a factor too. And when Trajan died almost 20 years later, whatever really happened, the reported machinations are very much on the Julio-Claudian model, for there were rumours of poisoning. The adoption of Hadrian was announced only at the very last minute, and some suspected Plotina, Trajan's wife, of manipulating the succession in Hadrian's favour and concealing the death until all arrangements were in place. Besides, despite the splendid meritocratic rhetoric, adoption was still treated as a second-best means of succession. When Hadrian wrote a little poem in honour of Trajan, he preferred to call him the descendant of Aeneas rather than the son of Nerva, a fantasy of genealogy that perhaps also hints at Trajan's overseas origin. Pliny ended his fulsome speech in praise of Trajan with hopes that the emperor would in due course have sons, and that his successor would indeed come from the belly of a wife. And when Marcus Aurelius was the first emperor for more than 70 years to produce a son and heir who survived childhood, that son succeeded him without there being any pretense of searching for the best man for the job. The outcome was disastrous. Commodus's assassination in 192 CE was followed by the intervention of the Praetorians and of rival legions from outside Rome, and by another round of civil war, which marked the beginning of the end of the Augustan template of imperial rule. Roman emperors and their advisers never solved the problem of succession. They were defeated in part by biology, in part by lingering uncertainties and disagreements about how inheritance should best operate. Succession always came down to some combination of luck, improvisation, plotting, violence, and secret deals. The moment when Roman power was handed on was always the moment when it was most vulnerable. Senators. Another problem that dogged the history of the 14 emperors over the first 2 centuries CE, and one that preoccupied ancient writers above anything else, was the relationship between the men on the throne and the senators, and the question of how the Senate was to operate under an autocracy. Senators were essential to the running of the empire. Among their number were most of the emperor's friends, advisers, confidants, dinner guests, and drinking partners, as well as the men who, second only to his own family, were likely to become his successful rivals, vociferous opponents, and assassins. Augustus had attempted a careful balancing act, combining extra privileges for the Senate and a parade of civilitas, with an attempt to reconfigure the old republican institution into something closer to an arm of administration in his new regime. It was a fragile compromise, which left the political role of the Senate under an all-powerful autocrat awkwardly ill-defined. Soon after the first Augustus's death, Tiberius exposed the problem when, in a surprise return to more old-fashioned ways, he attempted to get the senators to take decisions on their own, and they repeatedly refused to do so. According to Tacitus, when the emperor insisted on one occasion that they should all vote in an open ballot, himself included, one sharp senator summed up the issue with presumably mock deference. "Could you tell me in what order you will cast your vote, Caesar?" he asked. "If you go first, I shall have something to follow. If you go last of all, I fear I might find myself inadvertently on the wrong side." Tiberius is said to have interpreted all this as insufferable civility on the Senate's part, and every time he left their meetings he used to declare in Greek, "Men fit for slavery." If so, he failed to see that the free Senate he claimed to want was incompatible with his own power. Roman accounts of this period, largely written from a senatorial point of view, make much of the standoffs or open hostility between emperor and senators. Gloomy tallies are recorded, accurately or not, of senators executed or forced to suicide under every emperor, and notorious examples singled out. Most reigns are supposed to have started off with conciliatory noises from the emperor to the Senate, before, in several cases, degenerating into open hostility between the ruler and some sections of the elite. In his first speech to the assembled senators, Nero insisted that they would keep their ancient privileges, a promise that to some looked decidedly hollow only a few years later. Hadrian began with fine words about having no senator put to death without trial, though it was not long before 4 ex-consuls were executed, after no more than a rumour of a plot against the new ruler. Tacitus is not the only ancient historian to conjure up an atmosphere of deadly suspicion between the Palatine and the Senate House. Even the most discreet of the dissidents among the senators were always at risk from informers, who were said to have made their fortunes out of leaking to the emperor the names of those who were less than loyal. Others did not bother with discretion, but publicly paraded their opposition to the fawning and flattery of their class, and to the ridiculous excesses of the emperor in power. In the reign of Nero, for example, the high-principled Publius Clodius Thrasea Petus stormed out of the Senate after listening to a letter from the emperor justifying the eventually successful murder of his mother, refused to take the annual votes of loyalty to the emperor, and showed a definite disinclination to applaud Nero's stage performances. As a result of these and other crimes, he was tried for treason in absentia, found guilty, and forced to suicide. Tacitus had his doubts about how useful these self-advertising protests were. Of one of Thrasea's gestures, he writes, "He managed to put himself in danger without opening up the path to liberty for others." In this political context, the image of Brutus and Cassius as the upholders of the free republic and senatorial power, and as opponents of autocracy, could become a powerful symbol of dissidence. As we have seen, there was no realistic chance of turning the clock back to the liberty, for some, of earlier times. The Senate bungled their opportunity to gain some control in 41 CE. Almost 30 years later, in 69 CE, when Vespasian, who had just been declared emperor, was still abroad, they did not even make the attempt but, in Tacitus's account at least, sat down in the new emperor's absence to settle old scores among themselves. By this point, anyway, the idea of the republic had become for many little more than harmless nostalgia, a version of the good old days, and a source of famous anecdotes about traditional Roman virtues. Even as early as the rule of Augustus, the historian Livy could get away with being a well-known partisan of Pompey the Great, Julius Caesar's eventual enemy. Augustus merely teased him. Nevertheless, a public admiration for Caesar's assassins could in some cases be a death sentence for a senator. Under Tiberius in 25 CE, the historian Aulus Cremutius Cordus starved himself to death after being tried for treason. His crime was to have written a history that praised Brutus and Cassius, and to have called Cassius the last of the Romans. The book itself was burnt. The long poem on the civil war between Caesar and Pompey by Marcus Annaeus Lucanus, Lucan, which presents them as both terribly flawed and recognises true virtue only in the diehard Republican Cato, escaped that fate and still survives. But those views cannot have been entirely unconnected to the poet's part in an alleged plot against Nero and his subsequent suicide. The emperor's power to humiliate as well as to harm was also a major theme of disapproval. Gaius's joke about being able to execute the consuls at the nod of his head, and Commodus's performance with the poor decapitated ostrich, are only two of a string of stories about quixotic emperors terrifying or ridiculing senators in all kinds of ingenious ways. The historian Lucius Cassius Dio, whose vast compendium covered the story of Rome from Aeneas until his own day in the early 3rd century CE, described some of the most memorable incidents. As a senator under Commodus, he was an eyewitness to some of the emperor's extravagant gladiatorial spectacles. But he also tells of one of the strangest exercises in imperial menace, dreamt up by Domitian in 89 CE. The story was that the emperor invited a group of senators and knights to a dinner party, where, to their horror, they found on arrival that the whole decor was black, from the couches to the crockery and the serving boys. Each guest's name was inscribed on a slab like a tombstone, and all evening the emperor's conversation never strayed from the topic of death. They were all convinced that they would not live to see the next day, but they were wrong. When they had returned home, and the expected knock on the door came, instead of a killer, they found one of the emperor's staff laden with gifts from the party, including their own name slab and their own personal serving boy. It is hard to know what to make of this story, or where Dio picked it up. But if it is based in fact, it is tempting to wonder whether a quirky fancy dress party lies behind it. The spendthrift Roman elite are known to have enjoyed elegantly colour-coded meals, or even some philosophical display on the part of the emperor. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you die, was a favourite theme in Roman moralising. But Dio certainly tells it as an example of the emperor's sadistic games at the expense of the Senate, and of the endemic conflicts between the ruler and the rest of the elite. This is a classic tale of Roman fear fed by paranoia, suspicion, and distrust. The message was that no invitation to dinner with the emperor was ever likely to be quite what it seemed. There is, however, a very different side to this picture of the relations between Senate and Emperor. After Cicero, the best-known Roman letter writer is Pliny the Younger, with 10 books of surviving letters to his name. 247 letters in the first 9 books and more than 100 in the 10th, all documenting his senatorial career under the emperors Nerva and Trajan, with some backward glances to Domitian. Books 1 to 9 are letters to various friends, much more crafted pieces of writing than Cicero's, artfully ordered and probably extensively edited to hang together as a coherent self-portrait. Book 10 is a contrast, maybe not so much reworked, consisting entirely of letters between Pliny and Trajan. Most of them were exchanged after Trajan sent Pliny out in 109 CE as his special envoy to govern the province of Bithynia on the Black Sea. Pliny regularly wrote back home to consult the emperor on administrative queries or to keep him up to date, typically on such matters as local finances, overambitious building schemes, or how Trajan's birthday was to be celebrated in the province. That was an important piece of protocol, even where reputedly down-to-earth emperors such as Trajan were concerned. Throughout the collection, Pliny presents himself as the kind of cultured and conscientious public servant that Augustus must have dreamed of in a senator. He was an orator and advocate, largely making his name in the court that specialised in disputed inheritances. His political career, which started under Domitian and continued under later emperors, included major administrative responsibilities for army financing and the Tiber waterway, as well as the still standard sequence of political offices. It was when he formally entered his consulship in 100 CE that he made the speech to Trajan that covers, among many other things, the subject of children and adoption. Pliny's letters are not free from complaints and annoyance. He clashes with his fellow advocate, Regulus, whose character he systematically assassinates throughout the correspondence, pouring scorn not least on the man's eye patch and makeup. And he gets cross in a rather humourless way when fellow senators start spoiling their senatorial voting papers with smutty jokes. But overall, the letters offer a sunny and slightly self-congratulatory image of senatorial life. Pliny writes of his pleasure at taking dinner with the emperor, no tombstones here, his patronage of his hometown in northern Italy, including the gift of a library, his support of his friends and clients, his literary pursuits, and his amateur historical interests. A reply to a letter from his friend Tacitus, in fact, gives us the only eyewitness account to survive of the eruption of Vesuvius in 79 CE. As a young man, Pliny had been staying nearby at the time of the disaster, and years later the historian, researching that portion of his histories, asked him for his recollections. He was even on friendly terms with someone who cherished the portrait busts of Brutus and Cassius at no apparent risk to his own safety. The most striking thing about Pliny's career is its success across different reigns and dynasties, from the assassinated Domitian, who first noticed and promoted him, through the elderly Nerva, to the adopted military man Trajan. This pattern was not unusual. In one of his letters, he describes a dinner party held by Nerva, probably in 97 CE. Conversation fell to one of Domitian's most vicious supporters, who had recently died. "What do you think he would be doing if he had survived?" asked the emperor, with possibly faux naivety. "He would be dining with us," replied one of the clear-headed guests. The point was that it only took a little readjustment and some appropriate vilification of the last man on the throne to continue as a welcome guest at the new emperor's dining table, still creeping up the ladder of senatorial power. Even Tacitus, a particularly vitriolic critic of Domitian, admitted that his own career had prospered under his hated rule. It is another sign that the characteristics of individual emperors did not matter so much as biographical tradition tries to insist. So, how to explain the difference between these two images of senatorial life, between gentlemanly congeniality and an atmosphere of terror, between the relaxed and self-confident Pliny and those senators who found themselves the victims of the emperor's cruel whims, or hit squad? Were there two very different types of senator? On the one hand, an unlucky and maybe tiresome few who refused to go along with the system, took the emperor's jokes and displays far too seriously, made their opposition known and paid for it. On the other, the largely silent majority of men who were grateful to serve and prosper in the limelight of the imperial court, whoever the emperor was, were prepared to vote for book-burning when required, and did not think celebrating the emperor's birthday or overseeing the dredging of the Tiber beneath them. In part, there probably were. Over the first 2 centuries CE, senators gradually changed anyway. Many more came, as Pliny did, from new or relatively new families, and increasingly from provinces abroad. They may have been far less invested in some fantasy of the republican past, far less touchy about some of the more irritating examples of the emperor's whim, and happy to get on with the job. It is also clear that the most unbending opposition to emperors tended to run in families, a tradition of dissidence handed down from father to son, and sometimes to daughter. Thrasea Petus's son, Quintus Helvidius Priscus, followed in his footsteps and suffered much the same fate. He insisted, for example, on addressing the emperor Vespasian as just plain Vespasian, and on one occasion in the Senate heckled him almost to tears. It was not, however, quite as simple as that. Pliny was not blithely unaware of what had happened to some of the emperor's opponents, while he himself prospered during the rule of Domitian. In fact, his letters are carefully arranged repeatedly to highlight his close relationship with Domitian's victims. One of these memorably records the grave illness of an old lady called Fannia, a constant fever and a cough that is getting worse, who was none other than the daughter of Thrasea Petus and the widow of Helvidius Priscus. It provides Pliny with the opportunity to praise her noble career among a family of senatorial dissidents, and to emphasise his support for them. "My services were theirs in good times and bad. I comforted them in exile and avenged them when they returned." This does not entirely square with his success under Domitian, and an unflattering interpretation would cast Pliny as the guilty collaborator, backpedalling under Trajan's new regime and inventing a record of support for the opposition. But there was something more to it than that. Most Roman senators chose a mixture of collaboration and dissidence, which the first Augustus's awkward compromise between senatorial power and senatorial service made almost inevitable. The outspoken opponents of the regime were no doubt men and women of trenchant principles, but also blind, bloody-minded, we might say, to the careful balancing act and delicate choreography that in practice gave the relationship between emperor and senate its fragile stability. The majority of the senators were different, more realistic, less stubborn and less confident in their own moral judgment. In the evenings, among friends, they may well have entertained one another with those horror stories of humiliation and the abuse of power that we still read. They no doubt warmed the heroic opposition of martyrs in the cause of freedom, but by and large, like Tacitus and most other ancient historians, they fought their battles in the past against emperors whom it was now safe to demonise. In the day, like Pliny, they got on with the job of being senators, as most of us would. "Oh dear, I think I'm becoming a god." One of the big questions that lay behind many of the clashes between the emperor and his senatorial opponents was how the power of the ruler of the known world and of his family was to be defined, described, and understood. The idea that the emperor was simply first among equals was at one end of a wide spectrum of possibilities, and the status of a god, or something very close to it, was at the other. Helvidius Priscus tactlessly struck out the former by refusing to use Vespasian's imperial titles. Thrasea Peters objected to the extension of divine honours not just to emperors, but also to their female relatives. He staged one of his public absences from the Senate in 65 CE when the vote was taken to declare honours for Poppaea Sabina, Nero's wife, who apparently died after her husband kicked her in the stomach while she was pregnant. Whether tragic accident or terrible domestic abuse is still fruitlessly debated. Among those honours, she was declared a goddess. It was too much for Thrasea Peters to take. Poppaea, however, was not the first. She joined several other female members of the imperial family who had been added to the Roman pantheon since Julius Caesar had been declared a god in 42 BCE. In addition to the first Augustus and Claudius in 54 CE, the new deities formally decreed by the Senate were Gaius's sister, Drusilla, followed by Livia Augusta, as she then was, and Poppaea's baby daughter, Claudia, who had been deified in 63 CE, after her death, at the age of just 4 months. Official deification entitled them all to a temple and priests, and to receive sacrifices. There is no surviving trace of any temple for little Claudia, but according to Dio, a temple was soon dedicated to Poppaea under the title Venus Sabina. The idea of a tiny baby becoming a goddess must have outraged more than the diehard dissidents at Rome. But we have already seen that it had long been the practice in many places of the ancient Mediterranean world to represent overwhelming political power using language and imagery cast in divine terms. The kings who followed Alexander the Great in the eastern part of the Mediterranean, like the Roman generals who took their place, had been offered festivals on the model of religious festivals and used epithets shared with the gods such as Saviour. This was one logical way of making sense of men who had far transcended ordinary human power and of finding an existing category into which such superhuman people might more or less fit. The representation of the successful general as Jupiter in the ceremony of triumph and Cicero's attempt to reinterpret his loss of Tullia in terms of deification are other examples of the flexibility of a polytheistic religion such as Rome's. It is largely the legacy of the two main monotheisms of the ancient world, Judaism and its offshoot Christianity, that has encouraged us to see the invention of new gods, the adjustment and the extension of the pantheon, and the fluidity of the boundary between humans and gods as faintly ludicrous. Christians in particular both ridicule the very notion that the obviously human emperor was divine, and occasionally paid with their lives for their refusal to give him any kind of religious honour. But that is not to say that the divine status of the emperor was unproblematic for pre-Christian Romans, or that there were no debates and disagreements about just how godlike the human ruler, let alone his family, was. It was another awkward balancing act bequeathed to his successors by Augustus, who straddled the boundary between the human and the divine with greater success than some of those who followed. Some imperial claims to divine status were always thought undeniably wrong. For most inhabitants of the Roman Empire, it would have been a crass category mistake and a hyperbolic affront for an emperor to declare himself a living god, as if there were no difference between himself and Jupiter. The Romans were hardly stupid. They knew the difference between bona fide Olympians and a living emperor. If it is true, rather than a vicious slur, that Gaius turned the temple of Castor and Pollux in the Forum into the vestibule of his residence on the Palatine above, and sat there between the statues of the gods to enjoy the worship of anyone who chose to give it, then that was a memorable symbol of imperial megalomania, and it broke all the official protocols of imperial worship. It was likewise an abuse of power for an emperor to attempt to stretch the official Roman pantheon